week on Lean Out, we heard from Canadian journalist Jen Gerson. The response from listeners was overwhelming, and you have asked for more coverage of the collapse of our media, including, of course, controversial new legislation. Bill C-18 aims to save journalism in this country, but my guest on today's program argues that it has instead, quote, accidentally pushed the news industry into the abyss. Peter Menzies is a former newspaper executive and a former vice chair of the CRTC, the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission. He's now a senior fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute and a frequent commentator on the Canadian media. Peter Menzies is my guest today on Lean Out. Peter, welcome to Lean Out.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Really nice to have you on. Canadian media is in crisis right now. We are doing a mini-series on Lean Out on this today. And so I really wanted to get you on to hear some of your thoughts on this unfolding crisis. You are a former newspaper publisher, a former vice chair of the CRTC, and a regular commentator on the media in this country. So we'll get to C-18 in a moment. But to start today, can you just paint a picture for our listeners? Give us the broad strokes of the media collapse that we're witnessing right now.
We're going through a period of great disruption. I think people have underestimated the size of this disruption. To me, it's analogous to the invention of the printing press. The World Wide Web has fundamentally changed how we communicate with each other. And things such as newspapers, which had been in place for a very long time, it's pretty much 250 years in Canada now, their business model just collapsed. And it didn't begin with Facebook or even with Google. It began with Craigslist and Kijiji. Did Facebook kill or Google kill the newspaper industry? No, it was the internet that did in that sense. So we haven't read a lot about that, right? In our newspapers, there hasn't been a lot of tracking of that. Because newspapers haven't been very good at reporting on their own dilemmas. Media generally don't do that. The broadcast media can go to the CRTC, and it's public there what their concerns are. But newspapers have not wanted to make a big deal about the fact. It's sort of like not wanting to tell anybody that you're sick, right? You kind of consider it private. So we haven't been able to watch this as the years have passed. And then we had our own disruptions with the Canwest purchase of all the newspapers from Hollinger, and then its collapse and the formation of Post Media outside of that. And, there's some pretty good evidence to suggest that that ownership structure was more interested in, earning interest on the debt than it was in investing in the newspapers. So, probably because most sensible people looked at newspapers even 15 years ago and said, there is no future for this. So here we are. Everybody rolled the dice on Bill C-18, hoping that would be, their salvation. They would be resurrected somehow through that. And it was an idea based on an unsupportable premise. And it is failing, and they're failing with it.
So yeah, let's get into C-18. I mean, you wrote recently in the Hub an article titled "How the Government Accidentally Pushed the News Media into the Abyss." You wrote that it is difficult to recall a more complete public sector failure than this. So we do have some listeners outside of the country. Can you just set this up for us? What exactly is going on here? And it's often referred to a link tax. How accurate is that?
I think that's very accurate. What's happened is the government has decided that it has agreed with newspapers and other news organizations who were very late to the argument that Facebook and Google should be compensating them for carrying links to their website and stories on that website, even though that's in the case of Facebook. In the case of Google, it's for linking through their search through their search engine. And the problem, we can debate the premise that they actually should be or shouldn't be, But let's separate that for the moment, and you deal with the linkage. The problem is once you put a price on a link, you kind of kill the. Well, I don't want to use this is a word that others have used, but you know, there's the argument is that you're kind of killing the internet, right? The internet is all about links. In 2011, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that a link is just a link. It doesn't have an economic value. The content that you get once you make the linkage does. But this confused the issue entirely. So the way Meta and Google were looking at it was all they could hear was the ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching of a cash register going every time somebody posted a link. And they have no control over how many links are posted. So you could imagine somebody sitting in the Toronto Star's offices just posting one link after another, right? And to whatever it was. So that was a huge problem with the structure. And the other part with it was, even had they done that, they never put a cap on the what the cost would be to the tech giants, as they call them, to big tech. So when Meta and Google, no matter how much money you have, no rational business operator is ever going to agree to a scheme in which your costs are unlimited. You might have something in mind, like it's going to, oh, this is not going to cost us any more than $1 billion, or it's not going to cost us any more than $50 million. But you have to know. No executive in any company, even a mom and pop, convenience store, is going to agree with a business deal or comply with a law that exposes them to unlimited expense, particularly for these global companies. When, as our heritage minister Pablo Rodriguez has said, the world is watching. And I kept trying to write that and say, that's the problem, Pablo. The world is watching, right? So if you get $400 million out of these guys in Canada, which is a pretty active social media market, but nevertheless, it's less than 2% of the world population. All of a sudden that becomes 5 or 6 billion. If 500 million in Canada becomes 6 or 7 billion in the US, becomes I don't know how many billion in India and that sort of stuff. And all of a sudden that $70 billion a year profit you're returning disappears. So shareholder value and all that, that's why executives exist, is to protect shareholder value. And that's what they ended up doing.
And the government here has framed this as a real fight against big tech bullying. We saw our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, compare this to World War II. Pablo Rodriguez has begun to backpedal and back off. You recently penned a piece saying that this retreat is too late and maybe also too little. But let's talk a little bit about another aspect of the bill that doesn't get enough attention, which is that the bill will rely on the CRTC to determine which outlets are eligible for payments. Here's a line from a recent Globe and Mail editorial board op-ed on this. Bluntly, C-18 opens the door for the CRTC to decide if newsrooms are abiding by its view of proper journalistic standards of conduct and penalize those who fail that test. Even the mere prospect of such intervention is a problem, not just for newsrooms, but ultimately for all Canadians. Do you think the CRTC is equipped to make value judgments on what Canadian journalism is worthy and what is not?
No. And I think that's almost through the CRTC's own admission. The Broadcasting Act does give it the power, and C-18 does this as well, to be the final judge on what content is good and what it isn't. The Broadcasting Act says that the system must be of good standard. Now, in order to avoid having to have these judgments made by the 9 commissioners who are, cabinet appointees on the CRTC, and I was one of them once. I was one of them actually a couple times. But what the CRTC did, it was approached by the broadcasting industry and said, how about we police ourselves? We'll come up with some broadcasting standards for conduct. And they created a board called the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. And it, CBC is the only one that doesn't belong to it, by the way. But and that's in its way to assert its independence. But it then governs complaints. It's sort of like an old-fashioned press council and that sort of stuff. But its guidelines are approved by the CRTC. So the CRTC does stay in charge of things. But like in describing that, it's sort of like by its own admission, it doesn't feel qualified, like it has the internal expertise to do so. But C18 then insists that qualified news organizations must have a code of conduct, ethics, practices and principles, whatever, which the CRTC is comfortable with, right? So the Globe and Mail is dead right. I mean, look, if this is a commercial transaction, as C18 alleges, if this is really just about letting newspapers, you know, negotiate a fair deal with web giants, and I have some sympathy for the publishers in terms of the market imbalance, in terms of negotiation power. Absolutely, that's a genuine point. But if that's what this is about, and these guys should be getting more money from big tech, they can spend it however they want. Like, it's nobody's business how they spend it. They can spend it on new paint if they want, right? I mean, they can spend it on new furniture, a Fez lounge in the cafeteria. It, whether they spend it on journalism or not, is none of anybody's business. You know, the fact that the CRTC is put in charge of the Globe and Mail's values and standards and practices and how many BIPOC employees it has, and you know, I mean, the CBC's tried to do that headcount itself and met great resistance from its employees. You know, getting into all that sort of stuff, which is very much mandated through mandate letters to the Department of Heritage, is really, you know, to use the technical term, creepy.
Another issue here is the lobbying that has gone on from big media. And I'll be speaking later this week to media historian Mark Edge for a Q&A for my weekend column. And his latest book, The Post Media Effect, talks about the origins of this lobbying to government for intervention from big media in this country, dating back to 2016. What role do you think aggressive lobbying has played in the public policy solutions that government has wound up pursuing to try to remedy our declining media industry?
Well, all governments are prone to, you know, being overwhelmed by lobbyists. I mean, I've lived and worked in Ottawa, and you see it on a daily basis. People are all at the same parties, that sort of stuff. The casual interactions are there, plus there's the more formal interactions, the opportunities. And the bigger your company is, the more lobbyists you can hire, right? So people are perfectly, and let me get this straight, like people are perfectly entitled to lobby. What happens, though, and I really notice this as a CRTC commissioner, is every time you get lobbied by a big guy, you better make sure you find out what the little guys are thinking, right? So you get overwhelmed by News Media Canada that walks in the door and claims that they represent everyone, right? Which just isn't true, right? They don't represent the hub. They don't represent the line. They don't represent Narwhal. They don't represent, you know, all kinds of left, right, center, enviro platforms, you know, all kinds of platforms.
But they don't represent Lean Out.
No, they don't represent Lean Out, right? So they go and they make their case, and the government's come up with this sort of legislation that is essentially naive. They don't understand the impact it will have. Or somebody goes in and says, look, 450 newspapers have died in the last 20 years, right? Nobody shows up and says, hi, I'm one of 230 new online products that have started up. Nobody comes in and says, yes, the newspaper in Moose Jaw died 4 or 5 years ago, but it's okay. Moose Jaw still has 4 really good online news sources. Democracy hasn't died in Moose Jaw, right? That's something of what's happening is there's a transition, right? And nobody accounts for the fact that every commercial radio station virtually in the country launched a website, some of them in small centers in competition with the local newspaper. And that nobody considers the fact that it might have been the radio station's website that killed the newspaper, you know, along with social media and that sort of stuff, or that we have 700 new news websites in the country, all started by radio stations with, you know, and at very little cost because they already had a, you know, a news staff and newsfeed involved. So that's what happens with lobbyists. Is you only get a part of the story and you end up building legislation built on only one person's story. And that's why I've pushed in the last year, and we did our recent paper at McDonald Laurier Institute. We really need like something like a national news industry policy that takes into, you know, that really understands what's going on, right? So some things are going to die, no question, right? This is what happens. You can't go through a period of disruption like this without some platforms dying. Journalism doesn't have to die, though. It just needs to get a fresh horse.
And I want to get to some of the recommendations in that paper that you just referenced in a moment. But first, I want to just touch on a recent Angus Reid poll that found 59% of Canadians oppose government funding of private newsrooms, believing that it compromises journalistic independence. Holly Doan, who's been on this podcast, publisher of Blacklock's Reporter, has said she will not take government subsidies. And so has Jen Gerson of The Line, also a previous Lean Out guest, nor will I. Now, you believe that it's crucial to avoid a direct funding connection between the government and newsmakers or news intermediators. Walk us through your thinking on that.
Well, it's really not about what I think or what you think or what publishers think or what broadcasters think. It's about what the public thinks. And that poll really illustrates that. Like I've heard reporters say, "Hey, you know, that's not going to compromise me. I'm still going to do my job," and I believe them, right? But other people don't. And no matter how much you say that, and you know, I've had this discussion with more than a couple of academics who are saying, "Come on, there's no way that government funding, you know, can influence newsrooms and that sort of stuff." And I'm like, I spent 30 years working in newsrooms. I'm sorry, I know how it works. It's not as pretty as people like to think it is. It's not as ugly as people might assume from a comment like that. But there is influence. People, you know, executives do keep an eye over their shoulder. They do, you know, you do casually self-censor. You move stories in a different direction. All of these things occur. They don't occur on a daily basis, and they don't occur in overt ways. But what gets rewarded is what gets done, right? And people aren't going to put the sustainability, again, shareholder value and interest, at risk. They will try to do it in ways that don't, you know, corrupt a newsroom and that sort of stuff. But there's no question, again, that you know, even if you are as pure as a driven snow, if the public doesn't, if the public suspects that you might, even suspects that you might not be, it undermines your entire business platform.
And also, just another point on that Angus Reid poll that I just cited, 57% of Canadians say that the consolidation of our media should be discouraged to encourage competition. As you point out in your McDonald Laurier report, for instance, Post Media effectively controls 90% of the nation's daily and weekly newspapers. And you have argued strongly in favor of pluralism in media ownership. What impact does heavy consolidation have here?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Post Media ownership, and you could look at the Hollinger ownership before that, and even some of the Southern structures. I mean, some of this goes back to the Kent Commission in the 1980s, when you know newspapers were simultaneously closed down and bought, and that sort of stuff, and it became more consolidated. A lot of that has to do with foreign ownership restrictions. There've been some good arguments made on that, not just by myself, but by others in the media industry. If you restrict the number of potential buyers for an entity, you're going to lower the price. And if you lower the price, that makes it possible for people to buy more than one, two, three, four, five. And the next thing you know, people say, wow, this is more efficient. My costs are way lower if I just centralize all this, right? So all of a sudden, all your copy editors are working in Hamilton, deciding what headlines go in the Edmonton Journal or the Saskatoon Star Phoenix. People who have never been to Edmonton or Saskatoon are copy editing the stories, and and it doesn't work. It's sickly. It saves money. It's cost efficient and that sort of stuff. But Canada's an incredibly large country, and it's very diverse in its regions. You know, as I explained to somebody once when I was, at a meeting in Washington, he said, well, you know, Calgary and Ottawa, how far is that apart? And I said, funny you should ask. I've looked it up. And it's actually the distance between Calgary and Ottawa is about 180 kilometers further than the difference between London and Moscow. Right? So all of Europe can fit in between, right? So that gives you some of the size and the idea that people think a bunch of guys sitting in Toronto or Montreal, or it could be Winnipeg, or it could be Vancouver, deciding what people in Halifax and Baker Lake and Edmonton and Saskatoon should be reading is absurd. It downgrades the product to the point where today, like Jen Gerson calls them, zombie newspapers. And she's not wrong. They, you know, I read something the other day that said from one of the news media candidates, imagine if Calgary, Edmonton, Regina, Saskatoon, Vancouver were all to lose their daily newspapers simultaneously. And I read it and thought, they already have. The impact now would be what, you know? So once you depreciate an asset to a certain point, it's very hard to argue that it has a value that you need to retain. And that's really our competition policies in Canada are very, very weak. And we create duopolies all over the place. And we seem to think of it as some sort of cultural identifier.
Well, let's spend a few moments on where we go from here. So you did recently author a national news media policy paper for McDonald Laurier calling for this national news strategy and offering some recommendations. What do you see as the path to sustainability for Canadian media in sort of a broad strokes? And then we'll drill down on a few of your recommendations.
The path to sustainability is only going to be found through opening the gate and letting innovation and entrepreneurship run wild. I don't think anybody has a complete answer at this stage. I think there are some models emerging that appear to be, you know, sustainable answers. Like in Britain, the Daily Telegraph is making good money. It's not just surviving, it's making money. The Guardian started turning a profit again after years of not doing so, primarily based on a voluntary subscription model or donation model. The Times in London's doing the same. And these are the Globe and Mail, you know, Philip Crawley was at the Senate hearings and noted that, you know, they have 330,000 subscriptions and their business model is being able to shift from the old model in which 70% of your revenue was classified and display advertising to now it's 70% subscription revenue. And I mean, if you can get 300,000 subscriptions at $350 a piece a year, that's $100 million, right? That's a sustainable, I think, revenue model. It's not rich by any means for something of that ambition, but it's certainly you can run a pretty good newsroom, an operation overall on $100 million. Plus, if that's only 70%, you're talking, you know, another 30-40 million. You're building a reasonable platform. The problem is with most of us, most of the papers, as I was articulating with the previous question, is that they've depreciated the content to the point where nobody's going to buy the subscription model. Anyway, you need to take all those things into account. You need to have a good long look at it. You need to open those doors to innovation. And we suggested in the paper that here's some ideas to start with, right? You really need to get the, you really need to do some certain things. One of them, it was, well, I'll go into them one by one if as you wish.
Wonderful. Well, let's start with one that I wanted to kind of drill down on, which is extending tax credits for subscriptions. One of the things that I worry about with this idea is just that people's disposable income is not in a good place right now. So if you think about Toronto, median individual income in Toronto, where I live, is about $40,000 a year. The average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is about $2,500 a month. So if people's budgets are stretched really thin, and they have little disposable income to spend on subscriptions, how do we keep reliable news from becoming like a luxury item?
Well, that's what the CBC is for. I mean, that's one of the tricky parts about the subscription model is that there's still going to be people out there giving it away for free, right? And in this in today's world, you know, people talk about that. Well, we're not getting news. I mean, certainly your local city council or town council or municipal council isn't getting covered the way it used to, and school boards are running amok because nobody's giving them any coverage. People discover sort of 2 years later what they've done when there's controversy about it, and that sort of thing. But there's generally more news out there for free than at any point in human history. So I don't think that, I mean, while the cost concern is real, people should still be able to probably go to a library and that would have a subscription and read there the way they used to when there was just a printed newspaper and you had to buy one. I would suggest that there should be sort of, I guess, what you would call single copy sales, where if there was a story of great importance to you of which you were aware that day, you'd be able to just buy one online for a buck. Or buy a subscription for that week for $5 or something like that to create different models. But the broadcasters will likely still be, I mean, they're repurposing their content to a certain extent. CBC and CTV increasingly are sort of creating online newspapers, but I don't see any sign of them charging subscriptions for it because they're sort of double selling. So I'm not that worried about it. In other words, I mean, I think the average person will be okay. There'll be lots of news available. And I think if everything settled down and you had good aggregators, like you should be able to, for a very modest price, you know, buy Apple, something like Apple News, where you could get a good overview.
In terms of the CBC, so you and I recently sat on a panel together on the future of the CBC for McDonald Laurier. And your policy paper argues for reform of the public broadcaster. What are a few of the key points of reform that you'd like to see there?
The really key point is it has to get out of the advertising business. The government right now, I mean, the CBC is not a public broadcaster. It's in its own words, they told this in a panel I was sitting on a CRTC hearing. They're a publicly funded commercial broadcaster, right? And there's no other industry in the country in which this would be tolerated, right? Imagine, you know, whether it was the restaurant industry where there was a government restaurant chain that got a $1.2 billion annual subsidy and then went out and competed against every other Denny's and White Spot in the country. Nobody would put up with that. If it was an auto company or anything, you know, if you're going to subsidize, you have to subsidize evenly or not at all. And the easiest thing in this case is just to get the CBC out of the advertising business, which should free up $400 million in advertising that they're consuming every year right now for others to compete with. It should allow others such as the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, et cetera, to actually increase their rates a little bit, because if you have less competition, that's what's going to happen. So advertising, their revenue would be healthier. And it also, there's a number of other things that have to do with their content. They should be pared down to, I think, just a rather, I think, impressive, but nevertheless functional number of, you know, one radio station in each language and one up north in each language, or network in each language. And same with television. And then one all news network in each language. And get rid of all the other clutter, all your other commercial organizations. That, I don't think anything else, frankly, works unless you do that. I think that's fundamental. You have to have a level playing field for journalism industry to move forward. And right now it simply isn't. CBC can still be there. I think there's, you know, need for a public broadcaster in the country. I think they're of great value, but they can't be, you know, this sort of, I called them Franken-streamers, where they're, you know, they're commercial and they're not. And they seem to sort of take on that identity, whichever identity suits at the time. So that has to happen.
And what kind of changes would you like to see done to the CRTC?
To the CRTC? Oh, well, the CRTC's big issue with the CRTC, and it's particularly now with C18 sort of bringing newspapers into its scope, is when it does economic reviews of markets, like when it decides to do licensing, if it's a, let's pick, I don't know, Sudbury, just off the top of our head, somebody wants a new license, you know, has a, makes an application for a new license in Sudbury, CRTC does an analysis of the market, whether it's sustainable, you know, whether the market can sustain another station. But it never includes anything other than its licensed broadcasters. So it'll decide how many local TV stations there are and how many local radio stations there are. But it hasn't historically looked at, oh, and there's an online, you know, there's a, an online entertainment platform and there's an online news platform. Oh, and there's two newspapers, right? So it actually sees its world, and that's all it sees, right? So if you're going to have a sustainable media environment and having the CRTC run around doing these market analysis and handing out new licenses for broadcasters or retracting old ones, it should actually be looking at the entire news ecosystem, which it hasn't in the past. And I think that's probably produced some over-licensing. So you have, and then every time they license, they tell the guy that he has to do news. Well, that might make sense if you're in Humboldt, Saskatchewan, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe there's a perfectly good newspaper in Humboldt, and you never even had to make that guy do it. If he wants to do it, great, right? But you don't have to make him do it. Or if you look at markets like Toronto and Vancouver, where they're really out of spectrum, so there's no more stations, you could like 40 licensed stations, every one of whom has to do news. And all you end up with that is 40 poorly staffed newsrooms. Apart from your, you know, your all news stations, there's always, you know, in those markets, there's one of those. But if they just have to do news as a regulatory obligation, you've got, you know, a daily staff of one at each one of these stations. They all go to the same news conferences. They all get the same press releases. There's no real, there's no time, you know, bless their hearts, there's no time for any enterprise work. All you're doing is getting the same stuff repeated. And so it's not really adding value to the news ecosystem. So I'd like them to be aware of the fact that they need to be helpful.
And just lastly, Peter, to close, I want to ask you a big picture question, which is about public trust. We know that public trust in media in Canada is at its lowest point in 7 years. Something I hear from readers all the time is this problem of public trust. What do you think caused this crisis in public trust? And how, given all the challenges you've just described, how do we begin to repair that trust?
Well, I think social media activity has something to do with it. You know, back in the day, the only way people could protest to a broadcaster or a newspaper would be to phone them up, you know, write them letters. If you did something horrible, you could get hundreds of phone calls in a day. I've had that happen at newspapers, and that, and you know, you hear it, and you can defend yourself to the teeth, but you hear it, and you need to respond. I think what happened is with social media, to a certain extent, I think a lot of journalists were encouraged to have high Twitter profiles and social media profiles to sort of drive traffic to their websites and that sort of stuff. And for columnists, you know, say the Andrew Coyne of this world and that sort of stuff, that's fine. I mean, that's what you're selling is hot takes and that sort of stuff. And you got to have a pretty thick skin if you're going to wander out into that. But for the average journalist to be on social media, blabbing and blaring about their personal views on things is incredibly destructive. It's one of the first things. I mean, I was taught sort of as a young journalist is like, you know, you can believe whatever you want, but your work has to be balanced and fair and accurate and all that sort of stuff. And be very careful about what you say in public. If you're out on Friday night with friends and that sort of stuff, trusted friends, that's kind of one thing. But still be careful. I mean, for years and years, I never took out a political party membership. Nobody would have known. But, you know, as a journalist, I thought it was wrong. The only one I ever bought, I bought in, like, 2005 in order to get tickets to see Stephen Harper speak at the Stampede dinner because I thought it would be kind of cool to see a Prime Minister from Calgary speak. And that took me years to get them off my tail after that, my one year membership. But anyway, people were really careful, and people have been much too casual and much too cavalier about putting their own opinions out there. And I've seen some more restraint in the past year or so. So I think that seems to be, sinking in, that, look at me, look at me, look at me isn't really the best way to go about things. Post your work. The Globe and Mail is pretty good about it. The Toronto Star can generally be pretty good about it, having internal controls. Post your work and shut up. Let your work speak for it. And that's a start, because, trust is one of those pieces of social capital. And Francis Fukuyama writes about that, and we all know that from our personal relationships, right, in life, and our professional relationships. It's one of those things that's once destroyed, it's really, really difficult to rebuild. And sometimes you can't. So our news industry, our journalism industry depends way more than it depends on advertising. It depends on trust. And even the advertising, you don't get advertising unless you're a trusted source. As people trust the advertising, your trust rubs off on the advertiser. They always like that. But I think we're in a real pickle right now with that one.
Well, Peter, I really appreciate you thinking so deeply through the issues in the media and your research and your writing and all of your work to try to help us find a way out of this mess. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming on today.
It's very kind of you. Hopefully we can get some discussions going and about moving things forward. Thanks a lot.
Lean Out is hosted and produced by myself, Tara Henley. If you value independent journalism, please consider subscribing to my Substack at tarahenley.substack.com.